This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week was Wall Street's worst in 4 years. The Dow and S&P averages both dropped by more than 4%, and tech stocks on the NASDAQ took an even bigger hit. Tuesday's nosedive began in China when the Shanghai Composite Index fell almost 9%, a huge movement for one single day, and the shockwave circled the globe as Asian, European, and finally American markets responded. That was not the only bad news on Wall Street last week. The U.S. economy grew at a lower-than-expected rate in the last months of last year, and Alan Greenspan, the former head of the Federal Reserve, mentioned the possibility of recession. But China started the sell-off, and many were understandably nervous this morning when Shanghai, Tokyo, and London looked shaky overnight. So far, stocks are actually up today in New York, about 30 points or so. This leaves some big questions about the importance of the Chinese market, global markets, and the effect on the U.S. economy, and smaller questions about what all this means to your portfolio. You can call us with either. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can now comment at our blog. Just go to npr.org/blogofthenation. That's right, we call it the blog of the nation. It's all one word. Later on the opinion page, why the Oscar should go to every Brit nominated. But first, the markets. And we start in London, where Edmund Harris joins us. He's portfolio manager of the Guinness Atkinson Asia Focus Fund, where he specializes in Chinese stocks. Edmund Harris joins us today from the studios of the BBC in London. Nice to have you on the program.
Hello.
And is last week's big sell-off a sign of more to come, or was this just a one-week event?
I suspect there probably is more to come, but I think this is more a case of last week's events causing, I think, market participants to have a more of a collective gulp and realize that there are possibly other risks that need to be considered. And I think we've had a sort of a repricing going on in the markets, rather than there being any firm indication that there is something fundamentally wrong with the global economy.
So in the terminology we've, I guess, gotten accustomed to, this is a correction.
Yes, I think that's right. I think it is a pullback based on a realization that not everything is well with the world, that there are one or two risks out there, and that for the last 3-4 months or so, markets have really been only going one way.
And particularly in relation to the Chinese market, you did a piece of analysis last week that pointed out the Chinese market has been not merely rising, but zooming the past couple of years and was probably overdue for a correction.
Yeah, I think so. But I don't want to sound too glib about this. I thought that last week's events were fascinating on a number of levels, but most particularly that a stock market which really doesn't represent the domestic economy of China, it is ring-fenced and it is very non-representative, should suddenly be taken as a leading indicator for prospects for the world. And I can't think of too many examples where the U.S. has looked outside its own country and followed a stock market in the way that it did. So it does seem that, at least if markets are telling you in an unvarnished way, that China really does matter.
First of all, explain a little bit what you mean about the nature of the Chinese market. Why does it not represent the Chinese economy?
I think the first point to make is that participants in that economy are domestic Chinese, and they are unable to convert their local currency into overseas currency, so therefore they cannot invest outside China. And so effectively that stock market is, to all intents and purposes, closed, and therefore in that sort of environment you can find valuations and market behaviours to be quite extreme. It is also true that companies which you would normally expect to be using the stock market as a source of capital on an ongoing basis, in fact, do not. Most of these companies, in fact, use bank lending. And the stock market is in a very embryonic stage of development.
So that there aren't any, there are a few big players in the Chinese Stock Exchange, too. I've heard that this is the home of the individual investor.
Certainly, there are an awful lot of individual brokerage accounts. But the markets tend to be dominated by some very large players who are few in number. And these will be some funds, some state-owned enterprises, banks, and one or two high-net-worth individuals, and then a very large group of retail investors who are a good deal less sophisticated than you would find in international markets, bearing in mind these markets were only started in 1990. And so they are on a learning curve.
And you said it was peculiar for the U.S. markets to sort of follow this lead, but it wasn't just the Chinese lead. It was followed by Hong Kong, Tokyo, Paris, London. All those markets went down too on Tuesday.
Well, certainly. I think that Asia, in fact, sold off a bit, but I think Asia has become used to volatility in Chinese markets. When you do see a big move like that, it is a pause for thought. But I think the reaction that we saw in Europe and then the U.S. was a source of great surprise to Asia. And so when Asia followed the next day, then it sold off very heavily. But it represents, I think, a fundamental misreading that the fact the Chinese stock market sold off 10% in no way indicates a change in the economic environment in China and simply cannot be used to extrapolate global trends. But I think it was just because of the size of the move and because China is so much in the forefront of people's minds, there was an instant reaction, which then got exacerbated with cross currents of further information, further economic data, and comments from policymakers.
We're addressing the big questions that emerged after last week's sell-off in the markets, and some of the small ones too. If you're interested in what's happening with your stocks, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us talk@npr.org. We're speaking with Edmund Harris. He's the portfolio manager of the Guinness Atkinson Asia Focus Fund. He specializes in Chinese stocks. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Michael. Michael's calling us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes. I got a hard one question for you to ask.
Go ahead.
How is the U.S. investor affected by the situation on Wall Street?
Well, let's bring another voice into the conversation then. Howard Wachtel, Professor Emeritus of Economics at American University, author of Street of Dreams, Boulevard of Broken Hearts, Wall Street's First Century. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Good afternoon.
And what about Michael's question? What about the U.S. investor?
Well, of course, if you're in the market, you're affected. You would have lost some money in the last week. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have to make any moves. Whether or not you move this way or that way is a complex question. The real issue is, of course, whether or not a deep and protracted stock market decline, which I don't see, nor does anyone else see happening, could begin to affect the real economy. There's a real economy, and then there's a financial side to the economy that is connected, but the connections sometimes are not that tight.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that there's any concern at this point that what is going on Wall Street will have any effect on the rate of economic growth or other elements of the real economy.
And Edmund Harris, let me check back with you. As far as I understand it, the Chinese are still projecting, 8% growth next year? It's not as if their economy is exactly going into the tank.
Indeed. The rates of investment, loan growth, are all on track, and I think we're likely to see an easing of some of the monetary tightening that we saw over the last 18 months or so. So from a Chinese perspective, no, growth is well on track, and we can see that if we're looking for what's going on in the commodity markets. I mean, I know for that outside Australia there are 100 ships waiting to collect coal and iron ore to feed the construction industry in China right now as we speak. It's pushing up domestic shipping rates and creating tight capacity in the dry bulk shipping market.
But Howard Wachtel, I guess the reason people are concerned is because the two economies seem to be so integrated. We're, of course, China's best customer for all of those products it makes so cheaply. And, of course, we borrow a large amount of money from China.
Well, let me add also, I think the most important link is the fact that major American international companies are heavily invested in China, so that the rate of foreign investment is several hundred billion dollars a year now from American companies investing in China and then selling products back to the United States. So these are the same flagship in a sense. So that could be a worry. But the issue of China, I think, is very, very interesting. China has had this incredible rate of growth, as we know, and everyone is looking as to whether or not there will be a soft or a hard landing for China. It can't keep growing more each year. The trick is, in order for investment to keep coming in and everything to be working smoothly, China has to keep growing faster every year. So even though they may have a rate of economic growth of 8%, that's a bit of a slowdown. It's kind of like driving your car up a hill. If you take your foot off the accelerator, you lose speed. And that's, I think, the concern. Secondly, the Chinese banking system is very fragile. Everyone knows that their banks have on the books a great number of, in effect, bad loans that can't be collected. So long as the rate of growth is high enough, that's masked.
It's a Ponzi scheme. It doesn't come up.
That's right. It's like Japan was in the 70s and 80s. So you know, what we're looking for, I think, in the world is that the rate of economic growth in China will continue, but will gradually begin to slow down, and that the Chinese government will take seriously the problem of the fragility of their banking system. Mm. That's the real threat.
But let me ask you about the point. And by the way, Michael, thanks very much for the phone call. Forgot about you. The point that Edmund Harris was making, that and forgive me for paraphrasing, but he seemed to say, given the nature of the Chinese market, a lot of what happened last week was psychological rather than economic in terms of looking at the actual value of what happened in China. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with his analysis, although I'm reminded of the fact that every year we hear about an Asian flu epidemic. I never hear about European flu or African flu or Oceania flu. So the contagious effect of these things is we've had before. 10 years ago, we had another example of Asian contagion.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems as if we are now morphing in between financial and medical metaphors here.
Yeah, but the Asian markets were much smaller than they 10 years ago than they are now.
They were. And, of course, that started with a currency conflagration, which then spread.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with Mr. Harris's analysis. It's a very thin market. The only thing I would add to it is the fact that when you have a new market with new investors coming in and people with a very strong gambling instinct, you have all the ingredients for what we saw.
Okay. Howard Wachtel is with us here in Washington. Edmund Harris with us from London. If you'd like to join the conversation, big questions or little ones coming out of the Wall Street jitters, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Wall Street took a hit last week that's still being talked about as investors try to make sense of the biggest drop in 4 years. Today, the averages are mixed. Most averages down a little bit. The Wall Street Dow Jones Industrial Average up a little bit, about 15 points last time I looked. Today, your questions on the global market, the U.S. economy, and what it means to your portfolio. Our guests are Edmund Harris, portfolio manager of the Guinness Atkinson Asia Focus Fund. He's a specialist in Chinese stocks. Also with us, Howard Wachtel, emeritus professor of economics at American University, author of Street of Dreams, Boulevard of Broken Hearts, Wall Street's First Century. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also check out and make comments on our new blog. It's the first day. Go to npr.org/blogofthenation, all one word. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Brenton. Brenton calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello there.
Hi.
I was listening to some of your... The guest was saying, Mr. Harris was saying that it seems like the epicenter for the sell-off could have been placed at Shanghai, but everyone seems to be scratching their heads as to the source of maybe the sell-off, or coming up with an explanation as to why that would have such an impact on world markets. I was wondering if either of the guests would comment on maybe the fact the day before the Bank of Japan had raised its rates, and that might be unwinding the carry trade and having a more of a global effect than perhaps what the Shanghai market did.
Edmund Harris, what do you think?
Well, now that is a very interesting point, because there is plenty of talk about this yen carry trade. Japan has the lowest interest rates in the industrialized world. They're only 0.5% compared to 5.25% in the US and in the UK and 3.25% in Europe. So it is a game that some investors are playing to borrow in yen and then to reinvest those proceeds into other high-yielding assets. And following the Bank of Japan's rise in interest rates and potentially a belief that the Japanese economy is starting to strengthen, there is also the possibility that the Japanese yen may start to appreciate, and that will make this cheaper borrowing rather more expensive.
Hmm. And so now, that could that slow economic growth, is what you're saying?
Well, I think what this means is it's symptomatic of a belief that if the risks are now perceived to be somewhat higher than the perceptions were, say, last week, which is what appears to have happened, then it would make sense to draw back from some of those riskier trades, to sell off some of these high-yielding assets, to repay some of those yen borrowings. And that is something that could have an impact on financial markets and could go on for a little while. The difficulty is trying to establish how extensive this yen carry trade actually is and how much leverage has been employed in the process. But I still feel that this is an ephemeral sort of number to try and get a grip on, in just the same way that liquidity is difficult to get a handle on. And I think we're still in a process whereby investors are still trying to recalibrate where the risks lie. And it's now very important for investors to try and take a step back and think, you know, has anything fundamental changed in the economy this week compared to last week? And is there a clear indication that I should be now getting out of equities? Or is this something that is a technical correction that is maybe being exacerbated by one or two factors? It's very easy to get caught up in the maelstrom in the short term. And I think if you're a mutual fund investor or investing over the longer term, you really need to have your eyes set at least on maybe not on the horizon, but looking out 2, 3, 6, 12 months hence and saying, has anything fundamentally changed?
If I could just add to that.
Go ahead.
More directly, there was a rumor, and perhaps it was more than a rumor, that the Chinese government was raising the tax on capital gains. If that was the case and I was an investor in stocks, I'd want to cash out before the tax came on because I would avoid that tax. That was withdrawn, or the rumor was not correct, and that happened in China. So that would be also a much more direct, easier to understand for me explanation as to why somebody sitting there in their apartment with some yuan invested in the Chinese market might go down the street and say, I'm getting out before the Chinese government taxes me.
If I may add,
quickly, if you would. Yes.
Sorry, I was just going to add that at least as far as the Chinese stock markets are concerned, they halved over the last 4 or 5 years before rebounding very strongly in the past year. Effectively, between 2001 and 2005, those stock markets weren't functioning. And the Chinese authorities have been worried that a sharply rising market could lead to a severe crash and another 4 or 5 years of a dysfunctional stock market, and they really do not want that.
Good point. Joining us now is nationally syndicated columnist Elise Glink. She's written many books on money matters, including 50 Simple Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Personal Finances. She's with us today from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. Nice to have you on the program.
Nice to be here.
And we're talking about, taking the long term, looking out 2 to 3 months down the road, seeing if anything fundamental has changed. A lot of people don't have that kind of patience when they start seeing headlines like they saw on Tuesday.
Well, I think that's really one of the problems, is that they don't have the kind of patience that they need in order to really play in the market. You know, the timeline you want to be looking at is 20 years, not 20 minutes. 20 minutes, you're a day trader. You know, and that's not a winning game for almost anybody, although I'm sure your distinguished guests know a few successful people. But for the rest of us out there, we're looking, you know, at 20 years to fund a retirement or 30 years. And I think that the emotional need is to sort of say, wow, look at this big dive. I'm going to sell now because I'm scared. When in effect, if you didn't have to sell today, you haven't lost any money. On paper, you've lost some money. But in reality, you don't have any less cash in your pocket or in your 401k. This is the time to sit tight or even look at what else you've been wanting to buy, but it was a little too expensive.
So this could be an opportunity in some respects.
Well, I definitely think that any time you have a pullback, it's a buying opportunity. I mean, it's hard, though, to make yourself buy in, because what you have to do is get yourself over the hurdle that, oh, no, it's gone down, and if I put money in, I'm going to lose more money. And you have to get yourself over that emotional hurdle to say yes, but in any 20-year period, starting in any day of that period over the last 100-plus years, somebody ended up better on the other side of that than they did when they started, and that's what you have to keep in mind, again, that longer view.
Let's see if we can get some listeners on the line. Andrea's with us. Andrea's calling from Jacksonville, North Carolina. That's what it says here.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, Hi. Go ahead, please.
My question was, I'm in an investments class, And we've been following the market every day. And the day after this happened, I was telling my husband, I wonder if this would be a good time for us to look into getting like an international or an emerging markets mutual fund. And then a few days after that, you know, the market continued to drop. So is this something that we should wait until this kind of
plays itself out?
Is it expected to dip lower, or should we go ahead and buy now? Are emerging markets a good way to go right now?
I wonder, do you want to try that, Elise?
Sure. You know, it's funny because as I was sitting here listening to Mr. Harris and Mr. Wachtel, I was thinking to myself about how over the last year I've invested more personally in emerging market funds. And I do it by investing in sort of these larger funds. And you could go more specific. You could have had a China fund, or you can have an Asia fund or a Latin America fund, or you can even go down to the country. You could do an India fund. I choose to go a little bit more broad. I like a little less risk with my riskier investments. But again, here's, you know, the thing. These, when we talk about emerging markets, we add them into our portfolio at small percentages, 10 or maybe 15%. For an average person like myself, you don't want to put too much in because, as we're seeing now, it's very volatile. And there are traders out there that live and thrive on the volatility. But, you know, frankly, I like to sleep at night. So just a small piece of your investment portfolio, 10, 15, gosh, if you're a huge risk taker, 17%, go for it. No more than that,
we're
though, because, 20, again, so you got a long way to go. So if you want to do a little more, fine. But remember, the volatility that you're seeing here, this is a great example of why big risk, big reward doesn't always work out depending on what your horizon is. At 20, you got a long way to go.
Good luck, Andrea.
Thank you very much.
All I would add to that is the same advice always given: diversify. I mean, if you want to go into emerging markets, do it in a small way and diversify among emerging markets. There are some like China that are very big. There's smaller ones in Eastern Europe, like in Estonia, that are very strong and smaller. So diversify both among and within.
Here's an email question. This is from Rakesh in India, who was apparently looking west last week and not east. There is talk of a possible U.S. economic slowdown, he writes. The housing market has definitely slackened for the first time in many years. It was perhaps the only one industry which managed to survive the Depression. What will this mean for the global economy in general? Howard Wachtel, can you give us that in 30 seconds?
Oh, I don't think we're in that sort of world, you know, of the kind of great crash scenario. I think that, you know, people that have to deal with these, government policymakers, central banks, finance ministers, should be careful and should be cautious. There always is a temptation to develop new kinds of instruments that supposedly cover risk. That's the first problem. And we've seen a proliferation of those. And because they're new, regulators and central banks don't have a sense of what they mean. Like we were talking earlier about the Japanese carry trade. The yen carry trade. The second thing is the speed of communication. Computers have sped everything up. And in a financial crisis or a crisis of any sort, the phrase is we try to buy time. You want to slow the process down. Well, what we saw on Wall Street was the first test of the new all-computer era for Wall Street, in which individual specialists were more or less taken out of the game, although they had to come back in when the computers dysfunctioned. So this is the first test of the fully, you know, computerized trading system, not only on Wall Street but around the world. And I'm concerned that that's counterintuitive. That is, it speeds up the process, and it creates too much panic, in a sense.
It accelerates the velocity, if you will.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. The phrase is, you know, in a crisis, what do you do as a crisis manager? Let's buy time. Slow it down.
Here's another email question, this from Don Burns in Rochester, New York. The Shanghai market is often referred to as a gambling market and not a typical Western financial market with good accounting practices. Is the same thing true for the Chinese ETF funds listed in North America? How does one invest in China with good transparency? Hong Kong, Singapore? Edmund Harris, is this for you?
Yes, I think that sounds like my ballpark. There are plenty of companies. Of Chinese companies listed in Hong Kong, in Singapore, London, and the United States, where they are required to follow international accounting standards, where they are operating under stock exchange rules that are internationally recognizable, and into which investors can put their money and take their money out without let or hindrance. So there are plenty that I think would conform to international expectations, and the ETF funds and all the and the mutual funds that that are listed that that invest in these markets are all invested in these Chinese companies that are listed outside domestic China.
Here's another email question. This is from David in Phoenix, Arizona. With the increased growth of a global economy, is it possible for a country like China to manipulate its economy to deliberately affect the global economy? Could this be a new form of warfare? Howard?
Well, that's a kind of hypothetical horror story. If they did that, they would be cutting off their nose to spite their face, because they're more dependent on us than we are on them, in effect. So if they did that, it would be very irrational.
We're talking about market jitters with Edmund Harris of Guinness Atkinson Asia Focus Fund, with Howard Wachtel, Emeritus Professor of Economics at American University, and with Elise Glink, who writes a nationally syndicated newspaper column on personal finance. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's turn now to Michael. Michael's with us from Medford, Oregon.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
Hi.
How's everybody doing today?
I think we're all doing pretty well. Go ahead, please.
This is a very interesting conversation, and you guys touched on as far as the jitters go, the psychology of it. You just very briefly mentioned it, but it caught my ear. So my question is in relation to that. In the global community, what I would like to see each of your opinions on just that, the psychology of this jitters and the drop in this market. How do you think that will affect, and we're just philosophically speaking, how will that affect our future, as looking back, as history has told us all, has told me, there has been more, news about the great stock market crash back in the early 1900s versus like the Black Plague or anything like that. That seems to, the history of that psychology that, and the language of that that is, has transferred through the years has been more pronounced than, say, the death of thousands of people due to some illness or something like
right.
that. Money is a very big thing in our culture.
Right.
So I'm just kind of curious, what you guys think about that?
It's a fascinating question, and I think that if anyone knew the answer, they'd be very rich. What happens is that on Wall Street and in the sort of larger community, journalists and others that talk about it, the same information gets interpreted differently depending upon which side of the psychology you're on. 2 weeks ago, for example, we would have gotten information about the slowdown in manufacturing orders, and Wall Street would have said collectively, well, that's a good thing because it means that the Federal Reserve probably will not raise interest rates. We're heading for a smooth, soft landing, and everything looks nice. But 5 days ago when they got that information, it was, oh, my God, this is just another indication of the problems and the overextension of risk and this, that, and the other thing. So the psychology is what you have to watch for, is how it turns on a dime. The same information gets interpreted 360 degrees differently.
And Elise Glink, I was just going to ask you about this. Go ahead, please.
My feeling is that it's true that different information is interpreted differently. But if you as an investor really are focused on the long term, you've well diversified your portfolio, some international, a lot of domestic, but within domestic, small, medium, and large cap, dividend versus growth. You've got some real estate, maybe some REITs thrown in there. If you've really diversified your portfolio to the tolerance of risk that lets you sleep at night, what happens sort of on this day-to-day level, or what gets interpreted, whether we're going to have a U.S. recession like your caller, I think, before this one was sort of intimating at, you really just have to chart your own course. And so I always counsel my readers and my listeners to sort of pay attention to what keeps them up at night, and then your own time horizon. And if you've structured your portfolio properly, whatever happens, in sort of the larger reinterpretive sense, it doesn't really affect you on a day-to-day level. It's in your 401k, and in 25 years, hopefully that's going to grow and change and support you in your old age.
And Edmund Harris, how many of us are going to be waking up in the middle of the night to check the figures from Shanghai?
Well, I think the figures from Shanghai will look okay. I think things are going to sort of steady down. I think that the question that was asked about behavior and at what point it tips over into panic is an interesting one, and one that's been written on pretty widely. But I think certainly information gets gets, as the other guests have said, interpreted in very different ways. But the key problem when it turns into panic is when you discover that there's excessive leverage at the bottom of it. And I don't think we're at that point currently.
Thank you all very much. Edmund Harris, who you just heard, portfolio manager of the Guinness Atkinson Asia Focus Fund, a specialist in Chinese stocks. Howard Wachtel, emeritus professor of economics at American University. And Elise Glink, who writes a nationally syndicated newspaper column on personal finance. Thanks to you all. And when we come back, it's the opinion page.